you very much.
All right, our next case is 11-486, State of Ohio versus Dewan Emerson.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Moriarty. I'm here on behalf of Dewan Emerson, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes time for rebuttal. Your Honors, in this case, the sole issue or the main issues resolve around the retention or improper retention of DNA samples in this case. The facts more specifically are that in 2005, the defendant was accused of a rape. They took his DNA sample. At that time, they maintained it in their database, although the authority to control that database did not authorize such retention. The reason being, he was acquitted of that crime. Since then, the law has been changed to include that anybody who's arrested for a felony can be DNA tested, and they can maintain those databases regarding the DNA.
Counsel, was the DNA entered into the database originally in accordance with statutory authorization?
No.
You're saying it was originally improperly entered.
We're saying
not that it was improperly retained after it was properly entered.
What our argument is that although they had a court order to take the DNA sample, that it was improperly retained within the database, the CODA system, when the law does not provide for that. It provides for other types of retention for convicted felons, for relatives of missing persons, and for I think there were four other categories of individuals that they can retain these databases for, but arrestees or individuals who are acquitted of a crime were not involved, were not specifically stated in that statute.
Prior to the enactment of the change in the DNA statute, what was the rule on fingerprints? When you're arrested, you're fingerprinted. If you were acquitted, was that fingerprint database required to be destroyed? The state refers to that, but I don't know what the law.
Right. They try to make an analogy between fingerprints and DNAs. I think that's inaccurate. And the reason being that the statutory framework that's set up in Ohio does recognize fingerprints as part of the official record in any type of an investigation. And I think it's important to note that even with the revisions in the law, that still the official record does not include, although it mentions a number of things that it includes regarding notes that were taken from the officer, things like that. I think there's at least 10 to 12 items that are involved in the official record. DNA is, again, not mentioned in that.
What about if they took clothing from the defendant and had the clothing?
That would be part of the official record.
So the clothing can, even though it's his personal clothing and he's acquitted, that remains part of the record.
I believe that it would.
Then I fail to understand why is the DNA that is taken and retained not part of that record also?
The DNA, the DNA is something separate and distinct from a person's clothing or any other exhibit that's taken. And I think that's recognized by the law requiring, number one, a warrant or a court order or consent to go in and take a DNA sample in the first place because of the privacy interest that's involved. It's not just a piece of...
You have privacy interests argued all the time for personal property, and you require warrants all the time for personal property. So why is, again, that doesn't seem to be a major difference.
Well, again, and those things are included in the definition of an official record. DNA is not. Go ahead.
Counsel, first of all, if somebody's acquitted, I guess they're allowed to have their personal property returned to them if it's used into evidence. But in this case, the statute that was in effect at the time did not instruct what to do with DNA that...
Correct.
...did not... that was utilized at a trial, collected lawfully, and then there was an acquittal. It doesn't preclude its retention. It doesn't mandate destruction. It is silent as to what should happen. Am I correct?
You're correct.
So subsequently, the law changes, and the law expands as to what is permissible to be retained. And under the new law, your client's DNA, as retained previously, would be legitimately retained, correct?
Correct.
So if the law is silent, where is the objectionable behavior by the state here?
Again, the objectionable behavior is in the retention. At that point in time, the statutory law did not provide for the retention, although it did provide for other categories of retention. It didn't provide for that. And since it's been expanded to include that, you can almost infer that it wasn't included, and I think that there's no dispute that the earlier law is silent on that issue or did not include that as...
But there was no directive to destroy that or to remove it from the database.
No.
Statutory directive, but did your client make a request to have it returned or
no,
have
Your
it
Honor,
destroyed?
One of the things that the state argues is, oh, well, the onus is on them, first of all, to go ahead and either file a motion for expungement or sealment of that record. I would suggest that, number one, if it's being impermissibly retained, the onus doesn't go upon the party, the victim in this case.
When you say impermissibly retained, in answer to the Chief Justice's question, you suggested and admitted the statute is silent on this.
Well, the statute isn't silent. The statute provides for the retention of four categories of DNA. This is not one of them. So I would think by necessity that's excluded.
This was used at trial?
Yes.
Was it then a public a record?
No. DNA is specifically excluded as a public record. And it's also excluded in the definition of an official record. And that's why I think that a lot of the analogies that the state makes are inapplicable here, because the framework that's set up in Ohio specifically recognizes the difference in DNA. And that is, again, why a lot of the case law from other states.
Following the acquittal, there was no request for return of photographs, fingerprints, or sealing of any record.
No. And by law, I don't think that they could have sealed any type, and I still don't believe that you can seal or expunge DNA samples, or at least even back then. The statutes don't provide for that.
Well, does the statute provide for a motion to return DNA evidence to a defendant?
No.
So we don't even know what would have happened even if you would have asked for it.
And again, with that type of situation, how can the onus then be placed upon the man who was the individual who was acquitted of a crime to go ahead and take the steps, especially when statutes don't provide for the return of that DNA sample?
Counsel, your legal theory here is a expectation of privacy.
In part, yes.
Based on the U.S. and state constitutions. Is there any case that you can point us to that has indicated that DNA, which was legitimately obtained in the first place, once the need for it is over, an expectation of privacy unfolds to protect any further use of that person's DNA?
Well,
that's essentially the case. That's what you're asking us to find.
That, in part, yes. And I did come across a case.
But
I did come across a case in reviewing for this oral argument. It's called State versus Pearson from this court, and the site is 119 Ohio State 745. In that case, there was DNA that was taken lawfully from an individual. There was two rounds of DNA testing specifically. One of those rounds of DNA testing was attacked, while the other one, the initial one, was not. Or I should say the results were attacked. This court, didn't even address the issue of standing. And in fact, relied upon it, went through a whole Fourth Amendment analysis, and including the interests that are involved, and found that the inevitable discovery rule applied in that case. Now, it didn't specifically come out and say there's standing because of the expectation of privacy, and this lasts throughout. But I would think by implication, the fact that the court didn't even address standing but went ahead and found inevitable discovery as being the linchpin for that case, that it could almost be implied. And when I say in part, Your Honor, about what we're seeking here, it's not only State v. Pearson and possibly the implications from that case, but it's also the recognition that the out-of-state case law is not based upon the same statutory framework that we have here in Ohio. In Ohio, they specifically state that DNA records and DNA samples and DNA profiles are to have the same meaning. And that's why I think the 8th District Court of Appeals erred when the linchpin of their analysis said, well, you may have a privacy interest in your DNA sample, but this is a DNA database. I mean, they try to make a distinction there that's used in other cases outside of the state of Ohio. But again, that doesn't fly when looking at the statutes involved.
I'm having difficulty even having to consider the statutes because the statutes you acknowledge are silent.
No.
So I think we're talking about the inherent and implied privacy protections in the United States Constitution and the Ohio Constitution, as the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts have found them to be, and our court has found them to be. I mean, we do recognize privacy protections that every individual has, and I'm trying to get at, is you're really asking for an extension of that area of the law, are you not, to unfold a protection that is not found in a statute, a constitutional protection that arises once the need for the DNA or the use for the DNA that was legitimately acquired is over?
Your Honor, we're not asking for an extension. We're asking for a recognition by this court that Ohio may be a little bit different from other states in the way that it treats DNA samples. And in this case, the law at the time wasn't silent about DNA samples and DNA records and DNA profiles are the same. That law was in place. And I think that's an important distinction with all the cases that were cited to from the 8th District Court of Appeals, with all the cases that are cited to by the state right now. That case law was in place. The definitions in the statute 109.573, the definitions and
okay, but so I still don't understand your statutory argument. You're asking us to find if there isn't an express provision for the retention, statutory provision for the retention of the DNA that's in dispute here, then by implication, there is no right to retain or use. Is that what you're asking? You're asking us to imply?
I would say, first of all, Your Honor,
from the absence of a statute that covers this.
Number one, I would.
And it's meant to be your private property covered by an inherent right of privacy.
Number one, I would ask this court, and I think the first proposition of law specifically addresses it, I would be requesting that this court recognize that an individual maintains his standing in Ohio to address the constitutionality and the Fourth Amendment violations or alleged violations of the use of his own DNA.
Okay,
that's something that the court.
I'm beyond standing. I'm not worried about standing. You're here. You're standing in front of us, trying to assert certain rights. I'm assuming you can, and your client can. And my question is, how do you get there?
We get there, Your Honor, by the law that was created by the General Assembly. The law that defines DNA differently than any other type of fingerprints, than any other types of evidence, that it specifically provides for DNA databanks to be created, and at that time, only to be created for certain categories that didn't include my client. We're asking for that recognition. And again, when the state makes the argument that, well, they should have sealed it or expunged it, that's not possible. Because those statutes do not provide for the sealing of those types of samples or that type of DNA evidence, mainly because it's not included within any of those definitions that are set forth in the statutory framework concerning those things.
Mr. Moriarty, would you please give me the Pearson site again? It's not in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor. It is 119 Ohio State 3rd, 745.
And that's not a third district case that you're talking about?
No, that's Ohio State Supreme Court case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. McDonough.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, my name is Brian McDonough, and I am the Assistant Cuyahoga County Prosecuting Attorney. I tried this case. The state of Ohio asks that you affirm the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals in this case. On a preliminary matter, I would argue that this defendant does not have standing. In order to have standing, the appellant would have to show that he had a subjective expectation of privacy in the DNA in this case. And in this case, his DNA was lawfully, constitutionally collected pursuant to a search warrant. After that was collected, a DNA profile was obtained. And that DNA profile was simply a series of numbers. Those numbers, like ink on paper. And society is not prepared to recognize that that expectation of privacy is reasonable because appellant does not own his DNA profile. That profile itself, that series of numbers, was created and becomes the property of the state crime lab. So in terms of constitutional grounds, the state would argue that this defendant does not have standing.
He doesn't own a person. That was a pretty broad statement. A person doesn't own their DNA profile, but you're talking in terms of when the DNA sample was lawfully withdrawn. Is that correct and used in a criminal proceeding?
That is correct, Your Honor. In this case, there is a distinction between the actual DNA, the buccal cell swabs from appellant's cheek, and then what is done with that. From that sample, a profile is created, which is a genetic fingerprint, those series of numbers. The actual buccal swab gets returned to the investigating agency. So appellant does not own the actual string of numbers. That's what's created from the DNA sample and what's created by the crime lab. And in this case, was constitutionally collected and retained.
So that's an argument is your lab report, your DNA lab report, stays with the prosecutor's office, is what you're saying?
Correct.
We're not arguing over the custody of the swab or the blood sample or the hair or whatever might have precipitated that DNA lab test. And when it comes time then to match up or to retain something that can be later used to either include or exclude a subsequent, you're only comparing lab reports. You're not comparing actual swabs or blood. You're not retesting all of that, correct?
Correct.
You didn't retest the buccal swab that you got originally?
Correct.
Okay.
When that search is done, it's done on a computer, and those strings of numbers appear up as a match. And it's akin to a genetic fingerprint that the appellant would not own the particular loops, whorls, and arches in a fingerprint. Those string of numbers would be the property of the crime lab.
One of the arguments you make is the analogy to the fingerprint retention. And then you also make an argument that he should have filed for expungement and to get the DNA back. Is there any procedure when someone is acquitted to get their fingerprint profile back or expunge that?
Yes, there is. Although the statute is silent with respect to what does the lab do in a case of an acquitted defendant, the procedure would be the same. The onus would be on appellant to go ahead and file for an expungement or a sealing of the record. And in that case, the certified court order is presented to the BCI, the state crime lab, and then pursuant to that court order, the DNA profile that is within the database is then pulled out and removed.
And that happens also with fingerprints, or do fingerprints stay forever?
In theory, the same thing could apply. If someone wanted to go ahead and have their entire criminal history expunged and they have the fingerprints expunged, in theory, that same procedure would take place. In this case, appellant did not avail himself of that statutory remedy to go ahead and apply for an expungement or a sealing of the record.
And with the change in the law, is that still available, or is that record permanently retained now?
That record would still be available. The state crime lab, in order to be eligible to do searches at the national level, has to maintain a mechanism in order to permit samples to be taken, pulled back from the state level database. So that mechanism, even under the new law, remains in place.
Counsel, I'd like you to address just the overarching theory of expectation of privacy. That's long been an interest that I have had in the development of the law, and it seems to me here that the expectation of privacy that this defendant is trying to claim is a pretty hard thread to push, given I think we always have to look at what we've come to accept as our privacy expectations. That really is, what's the history? And as Justice Stratton has pointed out, and you make a point about fingerprints, every lawyer, every school teacher, every doctor, a lot of professions, you submit fingerprint profiles before you even get admitted to the profession. I don't know what happens to those, but my expectation is that they're on file someplace, even though mine was taken a long time ago, and that they're not just on file with BCI, but the FBI or whoever else now wants them. This stuff is ubiquitous. And isn't DNA sort of falling into that same category, much as we might not like it, that DNA samples and then analysis or your number thing is going on in ways that probably most of us don't even recognize, and retained and shared. So is it reasonable or is it unreasonable to say we have an expectation of privacy, that you have an expectation of privacy? I assume, as far as you know, your DNA hasn't been analyzed or on file with anybody, but do you think if somebody were to examine your papers or whatever you left behind here at the podium when you touched it, and ran a sample, that you would have an expectation of privacy with respect to that?
Well, from the podium, I probably would have abandoned it by the time I leave here. But I do think, Justice, that it is an important point as to what we're talking about here. The DNA, that profile, in terms of a privacy interest, is simply used for identification, much like the fingerprint, the different loops, whorls, and arches. And I think when you look at the privacy interest, this isn't the government saying, well, let's see what are your physical traits, let's see what your propensities are or what your disorders are. In this case, the DNA that is part of that profile is what referred to as junk DNA. Just based on numbers, you can't tell anything about it. I think down the road, with advances in technology, if that does become an issue regarding what is available and what you can pull from it, what the government can do from it, that would be an appropriate time to revisit the issue. But as it stands today, the use of DNA in terms of identifying people serves a very important part in the criminal justice system. And whether it's the forensic scientist working hard in London or Richfield or the Cuyahoga County Medical Examiner's Office, there should be an institutional memory that is permitted for law enforcement and for scientists. With the privacy interest in the database, the amazing, powerful, compelling opportunity to solve not only past crimes, but future crimes, as well as to protect the innocent as well.
Mr. McDonough, does your research show that other states have considered similar issues? I think the Court of Appeals referenced Maryland, but I was wondering what else you found.
Yes, Your Honor. Nationwide, states have adopted that. I think the case of...
We say adopted that. What do you mean?
In terms of taking the view of the lacking any privacy interest or standing interest in it, or having the statutory framework.
What states have held no privacy interest in a collection of DNA where there was an acquittal?
Those cases, I would say, in Indiana. I think the Fortune case in Georgia would go ahead and show that in terms of an acquittal, that there is no privacy interest.
So,
Mr. McDonough asked another way, is there any state that says that once an individual is acquitted, the DNA must be removed?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
We don't have any states that put that obligation on the state.
No. All the states put the onus, at Georgia, I believe, has the closest parallel statutory scheme, that the onus is on the acquitted to go ahead and do that. And I think the amicus makes that same point. It would be untenable to make a BCI over 1,000 DNA samples a year to make them navigate all the different avenues from trial court, appellate court, Supreme Court, federal, to put it on the government would be untenable.
And even if the record is sealed, did I understand that you said even if the record is sealed when someone is acquitted, there still may be the DNA potential that someone could use it later on to identify a particular individual?
Yes.
So really it's not a complete removal of the DNA from the system.
It would actually be removed in the case of a sealing. It would be removed from the database and actually put into a non-searchable database that would be appropriate for BCI and for law enforcement should that need arise. And normally that could be in a case where the person actually sues the police or something, and the police wanted to say, well, this was the person that we arrested. Once again, it would be in for identification
purposes.
See,
that's what's confusing me, because in this particular case, we have an acquittal on crime A, we have crime B, and the DNA from crime A, when the person was acquitted, is used for purposes of crime B. So the question is, you know, if we say there's a procedure where you can remove the DNA because someone has been acquitted, removal means it doesn't exist for purpose of using it for crime B later on. That's the question.
And if that was done in this case, if after that acquittal for the first case, if the appellant had requested it to be expunged or sealed, law enforcement would never have been able to search it, identify him as a suspect in this case.
Mr. McDonough, if we would find a privacy interest in evidence obtained from a defendant acquitted at a criminal proceeding, and if that law would obtain in this instance, this case would go back for presumably retrial. Is there independent evidence of the aggravated murder here that would be offered, or is this case effectively concluded?
The DNA that was the CODIS match in this case was the only evidence that linked the suspect. Before the CODIS match, there was no evidence even identifying the suspect.
So but for the DNA evidence taken in the earlier case, there would be no... There wouldn't have been a trial or a proceeding here.
Correct.
I want to come back to the distinction you drew. If I understand it, in thinking more globally of the privacy expectations. You indicated to the extent that DNA is used simply for identification purposes, we should not believe or should not find a privacy expectation. If it goes beyond that, and apparently you're suggesting, for example, I think there was a big case at some point where someone had unique antibodies that was discovered by the doctors treating them. So they kept bringing people in for further tests, and they were sub silentio harvesting the blood for use in a very lucrative thing without the patient even knowing it. There you're suggesting maybe if you want to talk about a privacy expectation in those kinds of situations might be appropriate, but not for identification purposes.
That is,
is that the distinction you're drawing?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. And in this case, the evidence was constitutionally collected, obtained, and retained.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Moriarty, you have a little over 30 seconds.
Okay. Again, Your Honors, DNA is not simply a string of numbers, and it can't just be used for mere identification purposes. DNA is a lot more than that, and the General Assembly has recognized that. And unlike all those other states that the state here relies upon outside of Ohio, this statutory scheme work that we have recognizes that samples, profiles, and specimens mean the same. And that's a difference that makes a distinction here in this case. With regards to using or being able to challenge the use of DNA at some other level, and I know, Justice Pfeiffer, you've mentioned possibly using it for other purposes than identification. Well, according to the state, they wouldn't have any standing to make that argument because, again, it's merely a fingerprint. We're asking this court to recognize that the law in Ohio says that DNA is not just a fingerprint, and the laws regarding expungement and sealment and all that do not apply. DNA is treated differently. And it's treated differently for a reason. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decisions.